This Loving Guidance audio tape is one in a series of live workshops presented by Dr. Becky Bailey. Dr. Bailey is dedicated to helping others shift from a reliance on fear to a commitment to love in interacting with young children. From the Indian Reservation of the Southwest to the university classroom to audiences worldwide, her message is the same. When you have conscious awareness of your beliefs, you begin to understand yourself. With this understanding, you are willing to bring new information and skills into your life that are more loving and helpful. Each of us is ready for a change, a more joyful, positive life. Dr. Bailey guides you to a new relationship with yourself and the children in your care. And now, Dr. Becky Bailey.
Your dirty fingers are on that door again. Why do you always do that? What's the matter with you anyway? Can't you ever do anything right? How many times do I have to tell you to use the doorknob? The trouble with you is you never listen. Hi, I'm Becky Bailey. That sound familiar? What I'm going to talk about is positive discipline as opposed to that negative discipline I just uttered out of my mouth. There's basically 10 principles that encompass positive discipline. I'm going to go through each one and give you kind of an understanding and examples of each. The first is positive discipline requires we understand children and specifically the unique ones we gave birth to or the ones we teach. Basically, by 14 months of age, the child's personality becomes very visible, especially when they're solving problems. So if you watch your child in play, you will get a sense of the child or the children on whom you're working with. So let's pretend, if you can envision it, that I have two things in my hand and they're puzzle pieces, and I'm going to act out some personalities you might see in your children or the children on which you teach. One child may try to put the two, and they're 14-month-old now. Imagine we're a 14-month-old, I have two puzzle pieces in my hand, and I'm trying to get them to work together. Now, one child may do it this way. So I try to get the puzzle pieces together. They don't work. I immediately drop them and move on to something else, thinking, well, a purse or car keys will be fun to play with. Another type of child will do it another way. They'll have the two puzzle pieces again, and they'll try to get them together, and they don't immediately go together, and they'll stick with it. They'll keep going and going and going. You can try to stop them. You can say, come on now, we're leaving, and they'll just stay right there. They're very persistent children. Another type of child, when they're trying to get the puzzle pieces together, may try to put them together. It doesn't work. They get frustrated, and they go, and they immediately come to you whining for help. Another type of child you may see is a child which are the ones that challenge us the most, and these are the ones in which they try to get the puzzle together, it doesn't work, they get frustrated, they go, rawr! And they might go relieve that frustration on a member of the class or a sibling at home. So one of the first things we want to know is what type of child do we have, because every child has a unique personality and temperament. And we can see those personalities and those temperaments if we watch our children at play. Number one discipline, then, is know your children. Negative discipline doesn't demand this kind of knowledge. Basically, shut up and sit down really doesn't care whether you persist or you're a whiner or you have high levels of frustration. The second principle of positive discipline is positive discipline demands we have a knowledge of how children develop. As I just mentioned, play is an important window into the children's personality, but play also gives us an insight into children. One of the things that's important to realize is that young children, as well as somewhat of the older children, turn fearful situations into a game. In other words, they'll take fear, and to get control of a fearful situation, they turn it into a playful situation, into a game. Let me give you an example, and I'm going to use a toddler because toddlers demonstrate this the best because they're so blatant with their behaviors. Say you have a toddler and you're trying to get your toddler from one place into the car seat so you can get off to work. Now, generally, we start off quite pleasant and we'll go, okay, honey, come on. Mommy's going to work. Come on with mommy now. We're going out and getting a car. We're going in the car seat. Come on, here we go. That's it. Come on with mommy. Here we go. In the car seat. Car seat. Car seat. Over here. Car seat. And we start off very, very pleasant in our request and our commands of the child. And what generally will happen is there'll be a pause, of which the child will give you kind of this certain look. And in that specific pause and that look in their face, we get scared. Now, as adults, when we get scared, many of us transmute that into anger quite quickly. Now, we must hold on to the idea that all anger is fear. With that in mind, you can decide how quickly does yours transform from fear to anger. If you can imagine yourself driving down a freeway or something and someone pulls out in front of you, some people get quite upset and start hollering obscenities. All right, you sorry, but very, very quickly. Their fear of being hurt, their fear of having a wreck, their fear of bodily damage or hurting someone else quickly turned into anger. Some of us don't know for 2 or 3 days that our fear turns into anger. So you either transform quickly or it takes a while. But basically, all anger is fear. So let's go back to our example with the toddler. So here's a toddler. We're trying to get the toddler into the car seat. So we start off very, very pleasant, very similar to how we start off if you're an early childhood teacher in the morning when we say, good morning, boys and girls. Let's come to the circle. We're very, very pleasant. All right, so now we're trying to get this child into the car seat. We have this pause on the face. In that pause, we get scared, and then we change our tone of our voice, and we change our attitude a bit, and we go, don't start. Don't start. I'm not doing this morning. I'm not putting up with that. Now you get over here and get in that car seat. Now, without our awareness, what we have done is sprinkled fear into the atmosphere, similar to like Tinkerbell, if you can imagine going, just sprinkle a little fear, a little fear. And children, in their intuitive wisdom, smell that fear. You can hear them go, and they go, fear. And they're going to turn that fear into a game. What you generally will see is this little teeny short person putting their hands on their hips, giving you kind of a slight grin with their face, and off they run. They run the other way from you. And of course, that infuriates us. Many of us interpret that as disrespect, and now we're chasing the child. Not only are they running and we're chasing them, they turn around and giggle at us, and we get furious. So that when we grab that child, we're like, I'll show you, you'll never do that again, and we tuck them on our arm, we throw them in that car seat to show them who's boss. But what has happened is they are taking the fear we put into the atmosphere, turning it into a playful situation so they can master it. We've interpreted it as disrespect, and in that interpretation, we've become more out of control, adding more fear, and they have turned it into more of a game, and the cycle continues. Now, that's toddlers. The same thing happens with preschoolers. If you've ever noticed how preschoolers reason, if you've tried to reason with them, let me take another example. Let's say you have a young child, a 3 or 4 year old, and they say, I want to go outside and play. And you say, look, you can't go outside. It's raining. They say, no, I want to go outside. I want to go outside. You go, it's raining. You can't go outside. You'll get wet. And they go, I want to go. I want to go. I want to go. So in our wisdom, we thought, So we toss them out the back door. They go out there. They get drenched. They come back into the house sopping wet. And in our beautiful wisdom, we go, told you so. See, you're wet. And they go, no, I'm not. So young children, 3 and 4 and 5 year olds, they just change reality at will. If it's not what they want, they just change the situation. So they turn and they change reality as much as they change their clothes. So basically, they just change reality to meet their own needs as to what they want. So trying to reason with them or telling them any kind of situation like that candy will rot your teeth, they'll just go, no, it won't. Now, older kids, when they get into school age, when they turn fearful situations into a game, their games are more like the games we play. So if we've been manipulative with them, then they're going to be manipulative back at us. And that, of course, infuriates us. So that's one thing we want to know about children. They turn fearful situations into a game. Another piece of knowledge that would be help us in disciplining children is that children have no inner speech until the age of 6 or 7. That basically means no one's talking in their head. Think of it about yourself. Do you talk in your head? How often you talk in your head? Most of us do it incessantly. We talk to ourselves in our head. Now, children cannot do that, so you can imagine what will happen. They're constantly talking out loud. If you've ever been on a family vacation with a 3, 4, 5 year old child in the back seat of the car, it's like, I'm going to go in there, little bunny foo-foo, there we go, here we go, we're going to play it around and around and around and around and go, here we go, now we go, and you would pay them $15 just to shut up for 5 minutes. So children do not have any inner speech till about the age of 6 or 7. That means there's nobody talking to them in their head. Now, how do we use information in our head? Basically, we use it to organize ourselves and to plan ahead. As you're walking into a new experience or whatever the case may be, we're constantly, all right, here, I'm going to walk in, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. So we manage, we govern, we organize, and we plan our behavior by our inner speech. Children have none of that. Now, what do they have in their head? They have pictures. Children have pictures. It's like they have the video but no audio. So as they create the pictures in their head, their body moves and their mouth talks about what's happening in their head. Now, one way to check this out, and I encourage you to check out everything I say, go out and try it for yourself, is if you're in an early childhood classroom, is to sing the song John Jacob Jingleheimer Smith. And for some of you who don't know the song, basically it goes, John Jacob Jingleheimer Smith, his name is my name too. Whenever we go out, the people always shout, there goes John Jacob Jingleheimer Smith, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And what you do is you sing that over and over again, and you get softer and softer and softer and softer until you're only mouthing the song, and only your mouth moves with the words as you're singing. Now, what happens if, as children are singing this with you, when it gets down to the point where you just mouth the words, instead of their mouth moving in the shape of saying John, so you could see them forming the word John in their mouth, they'll just be opening their mouth and flapping it like they were in the wind, going blah, 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 and just not making any noise because they're unable to have a word in their head and form their mouth to say the word in their head, and you know at that point they do not have inner speech. Another way to assess this is to have kids 3, 4, 5, 6, even 7 years of age, and lay out a number of objects. Say you lay out a number of objects they can't sight count. So say you lay out 7 objects on a table and you say to the children, okay, count the objects on the table. Well, basically what they'll generally do is they'll point their finger, bob their body, and say out loud, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And you go, ooh, that's wonderful. Now change the number so it's like 6 and then say, all right, that's great. Now put your hand behind your back and you may not use your hand. Basically, what they will do is they'll bob their body and count out loud, going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then change the number around, say you have 8 out there now, and you say, ooh, that was wonderful. Now I want you to hold your body perfectly still and count the number. Some of them at that point will say, I can't do it. And you know right then you've got a kinesthetic learner. But some will be able to do it, and they'll do it kind of by squinching their mouth or wiggling their face. And so they go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 8. Mix the numbers up, and the same, that was wonderful. Now I'm going to mix the numbers up and say you put out 5 again, and you say, now I want you to stand perfectly still, put your hands behind your back, and I want you to be quiet so you cannot talk. How many are there? And basically, most children will say, I don't know. That children do not have inner speech has profound implications on a process we call timeout. All too often, you will hear parents and or teachers sending young children often to timeout saying such things as, you just sit over there and think about what you did wrong. Now, as you can imagine, they cannot do that. And what happens also is you'll see them start to wiggle when they say, now you think about it, and the kids will start wiggling or moving their body and stuff, and you'll go, now just sit still. Sit still and think about it. And of course, they get this glazed look over their face, or they'll start picking the paint off the chair or picking at their fingers just to keep their mind occupied until it's time to come back out. Another thing we need to know about child development is children cannot conjugate the negative verb don't until around the age of 6 or 7. What this means is when we say, don't run, don't run, don't climb, don't hit your friends, don't touch that, we are saying, run, run, hit your friends, touch it. Because they are unable to do that until around the age of 6 or 7. Let's go back and use a toddler example again. Now, toddlers are wonderful demonstrators of human behavior. So take any toddler and hold up, and let's say you have this wonderful piece of crystal, glass crystal, and that you do not want the toddler to explore. And of course, the toddler wants to explore it, but the toddler sees it, and you see the toddler approaching the crystal, and you go, don't touch, don't touch. And almost throughout this whole entire country and every culture in the world that uses this type of language system, that child will put out its pointer finger with that thumb sticking out in the pointing position, look at your face, Then touch the crystal and look back at you and smile. Now, have you ever wondered why that happens? Because in their mind, you have said, touch the crystal, touch the crystal. And here this child touches the crystal, looks back at your face for that approval from their very important significant other, and we go, that's it, I've had it with you, or we smack them on the hand. These mixed messages are certainly hard on each and every one of us. So we have to understand that they do not process that. So we must tell children what to do. Instead of don't touch the crystal, tell them, oh, put your hands on your, put your hands over here next to mommy's. Bring your hands to me. If you want, if they've got their hand in your face or their hand in your hair, instead of don't touch my hair, go, put your hand on my shoulder. It's important to tell children what to do. Now, you might say, oh, they understand what I'm saying. I know they know what I mean. Well, certainly remember that 55% of all communication is nonverbal. 48% of communication is your tone of voice, and only 7% is the actual words we say. These young children are very adept at picking up that 93% of communication. So yes, indeed, they know they have done something wrong, which they translate into, I must be bad, but they have no clue of what to do. Basically, the research on don't came from a baseball player. And there was this baseball player who was a pitcher, and one of those great situations where it was the World Series and there the winning run was on third and a big hitter comes to the plate and the guy's getting ready to pitch and the manager calls timeout, comes out on the field, and he goes up to the pitcher and he says, don't throw a curveball. Well, as you can imagine, the manager goes back into the dugout, the pitcher's standing up there, and his brain has received the message, don't throw a curveball. Now, he has to, in his head, mentally translate what he is to do. So at this time, he has a 50% chance of throwing a curveball and a 50% chance of throwing what his other choice, which he chose, was a fastball. So the brain has received two messages. One is the curveball, and the one is his replacement fastball. He winds up, lets go, throws a curveball. The guy hits it, the run scores, and this particular baseball player, who I can't remember his name, goes on to write books about how we need to instruct people on what we want them to do. So now, if you can imagine this professional pitcher unable to translate what not to do into what they can do, imagine what it does for young children or any person at all. So what we want to make sure is we tell children what to do. The next thing is, children are egocentric. Now, you may have heard this before. Egocentric basically means that children see the world from their own point of view. Now, let me give you an example of this. I was in the mall, and I love going through malls. Some of my favorite activities are following families in malls and in grocery stores because I get such wonderful stories from it, and also I get a real glimpse at just the basics of human behavior. So I was walking through the mall. Here's this family, and it was a mother, and she had one of those strollers with the two children in it. In the back of the stroller was the older boy who appeared to be about 4 years of age. And in the front of the stroller was a child who appeared to be about 10 months old. And so she's strolling down the mall. Now, on top of the stroller, it had a lid in it, and it, fortunately, probably for her, she couldn't see through it. So underneath there, the kid in the back was just pounding on his brother's head. He'd go, bap, and the kid go, wah, bap, bap, wah, wah. And he was just having this delightful time beating on his brother. And the mother is just kind of, as the child keeps crying, she's just getting a little bit beside herself, and she stops every time the child cries, and she pushes the stroller back and forth in kind of a soothing motion, but she can't really see what's going on. So I approached this family, and I said to the mom, I said, how are you doing? And she goes, oh, my gosh. I said, well, you look tired. You got yourself a handful here. And started a little chit-chat. And then I said, oh, you have such beautiful children. May I look at them? So she said, sure. And I bent down underneath, and when I looked at the child, I turned to the little boy in the back, and I said, when you hit him on the head and he cries, that means he doesn't like it. So when he cries, he's saying, I don't like it. Stop. And the little boy's face, if you could have seen it, he just went, oh, almost saying, that's why he's crying? The child was so egocentric, he could only see the world from his perspective. To him, that boy, his younger brother in front of him, was no different than a wind-up toy where you wind it up and the drum beats, or you push in the stomach of the bear and the bear goes beep, and you push it, it goes beep. So he just hit his brother and went, wah, wah. He had no idea from the other person's perspective. One of the things we have to do as parents and teachers is constantly provide young children with both perspectives. So what I did in that situation was basically go up and give the child the information from the perspective of the other child. And we have to do this just as naturally as if we put on our shoes. So if you're in a classroom situation, one child grabs someone else's toy, and you need to say, oh, look at his face. He's saying he doesn't like that. Then you need to teach the child who was grabbed from to use words to express his point of view to the attacker. So it's important with positive discipline, which is the second principle of positive discipline, to know, have some knowledge of how children develop, because this will give us information as to how to better deal with them. The third principle of positive discipline is positive discipline holds adults accountable as models. Negative discipline does not matter. Negative discipline goes on the premise, do what I say, not what I do. Positive discipline understands that's not how children learn. They know that we are powerful models and they learn through our actions and our acts, not necessarily our words. Now, some of us have got an essence of this through the classic one where we hit a child and say, now don't you hit. So we're hitting at the same time we're telling them don't hit. Therefore, we're modeling the exact behavior we're trying to get rid of. So a lot of us are familiar with that. Some other examples that might not be to our awareness yet that I've seen in classrooms throughout the whole country is such things as, I said use inside voices! So I've heard teachers screaming at children in an attempt to get them quiet. Also, I've had kids and seen kids in a classroom where they both are holding dearly onto an object. Let's say they both have one particular firefighter's hat and both are holding and screaming, it's mine, I had it first, my mommy gave it to me. And both children are screaming and holding from the same perspective. And so the teacher goes up and takes it, grabs the firefighter hat, jerks it out of their hand and says, you know better than to grab things from other people. So again, we're grabbing at the same time we're saying, don't grab. Another one I've seen quite often is teachers who say something like this, or even parents. Now you go to your room right now so you can get control of yourself. I'm tired of seeing you out of control. Now go on in there. We are getting out of control and modeling that at the same time we're demanding children get in control. Another one you will see quite often is parents go, boy, that was really stupid, huh? I was just really smart calling your friends names, huh? How many friends are you going to have if you keep up with that? Really stupid. So in that situation, we do this kind of lecture approach, but we call the children stupid. We call them names in a reprimand for calling their friend's name. Another one I've seen quite often is pushing in line. In classrooms, especially in early childhood, lining children up is quite a chore. I'm not sure that's a natural thing to do. But there's always this jostling at the door for those first five positions. And there's always you butted, you pushed, you did this. And so lots of times you'll have kids going, he pushed. And sometimes you'll see teachers come in, grab a child, jerk them out of line, and take them bodily, pushing them. You get back there and go to the end of the line as they forcibly push the child back. And again, they're pushing the child, trying to teach the child not to push. The fourth principle of positive discipline demands the adult maintain self-control. Think of what I'm about to explain in regard to behavior in terms of an equation. It will help you better visualize what I'm going to talk about. What causes us to behave in a certain way? Basically, right now, we believe it's the choices we made. For example, you made a choice to purchase this tape. Regardless of your reasons, that influences your behavior because you made a choice to purchase the tape. Something that's said on here might have touched something inside of you, and therefore your behavior may change. But what causes us then to choose certain things? What causes us to make certain choices. Basically, it's our feelings. Our feelings about certain situations create our choices, which create our behaviors. What causes us then to have our feelings is our thoughts. Now, basically, we have always thought differently in regard to feelings and thoughts. We've always thought that feelings alone can cause irrational behavior, and that if you could just get rid of the feelings, if you could X out the feelings, everybody would be all right. And that's why one of the reasons we don't want to have women in high positions, because women can be emotional and therefore irrational. In other words, their feelings create a situation in them where they then are out of control of their behavior. But as I just said, feelings are caused by thoughts. So basically, it's our thoughts that have a feeling. For example, if I said right now, on three, when I say three, I want you all that are listening to this tape to have a feeling. No thoughts now, just a feeling. Ready? One, two, three, feel. As you might well guess, you couldn't do it. However, if you were pregnant, you probably could. There are exceptions. When you're pregnant, because of severe hormonal changes, you can have feelings without thoughts. And of course, it's a very discerning feeling for yourself and for those around you. But basically, thoughts cause feelings, feelings cause choices, and choices cause behavior. But what causes the thoughts that we have? Those are our beliefs. And where do we get our beliefs from? They come from what we call programming. Our programming is basically that which we have heard over and over and over again in our lives. In other words, that which we have heard 2,000 times in context becomes a program, which becomes a belief, which then dictates our thoughts, which then controls our feelings, which then gives us certain choices, which then creates a certain behavior that we have. So the age-old question then, I've always been asked, how many times do I have to tell you? Well, the answer is 2,000 times in context, because that's how long it takes to become a concept or a program. Now, when it comes to self-control, what we have to do then, instead of trying to wipe out all our feelings, we must try to get control of the thoughts in which we have. At any given moment, we can choose upsetting thoughts or calming thoughts. Think of situations in your life or triggers that spin you out of control. For some people, it could be when their child whines. For some, it could be talking back. For some, it could be hitting other people or being just disrespectful to adults, however you may define that. Those push our buttons. And what does push our buttons means? In other words, it triggers something in us of which certain thoughts start being created inside our head. These thoughts snowball and become larger and larger and larger. One upsetting thought leads to another upsetting thought, which leads to another upsetting thought, until ultimately we are out of control and doing things we wish we didn't do. Now, let's think of a situation here. For example, let's say we have a child in a classroom and his name is Jason. And Jason repeatedly is unable to stay in his seat and wanders around the room and is quite disruptive and picks on other children, thereby isolating himself, which creates more and more problems. So here it comes another day, and Jason starts getting up out of his seat and wandering around the room. At that moment in time, you have a choice to choose an upsetting thought or a calming thought. If your mind inside your head now, this is your inner speech talking, if in your head you go, oh no, I'm not going to put up with that again. He's not going to pull this off again all day long. I won't have it. I don't get paid enough. I'm not going to put up with this. Who on earth does he think he is? And who does he think he's trying to fool? I'm not going to let this happen. And things keep accelerating, accelerating in your head, to the point that when you show up to interact with Jason about being out of his seat, you then do what we call negative discipline. So we would approach Jason in a whole different situation. We go, Jason, I've had it now. You've been doing this all week. Now I've had enough of this. Now you just get in your chair and sit down, or there's no recess. I will not have this. You're just trying to mess with me, and I don't want this in my classroom. Now stop it right this minute and go over there and sit down and get out of my face. Now we get into the negative discipline, which we get into telling what we don't want to do. We get into the name calling. We get into the tone of voice that says you're no good. Instead, we can choose, when Jason starts to get up and wander around the room, we can choose calming thoughts with inside our head. So instead of going, all right, you're not going to do this to me today, I could start my, as that thought comes in my head, which it probably will because it's almost like a knee-jerk reaction to it because based on my family system, once I hear myself go, all right, you're not going to do that to myself. You're not going to do that to me today. I can take that upsetting thought and replace it with a calming thought, something like, all right, I'm going to stay calm so that I can help Jason with his problem. Now, you could imagine now if I have calming thoughts to myself when I actually arrive to interact with Jason after I've been walking across the room going, all right, I'm calm, I can handle this, I can help Jason with his problem, I can help him focus, I can help him get settled. Once you show up with Jason, you're going to present a whole different situation when you arrive. You may say something like, Jason, when you get up and wander around the room when I'm trying to teach, I feel really distracted and it's hard for me to follow what I'm doing. It's time for you to sit in your chair and look up front and pay attention to me. Now you have a choice, Jason. You can sit over here and pay attention, or you can sit in this chair and pay attention. What's your choice? So in that instance, my interactions with Jason, I told him what he wanted to do. I provided him with a choice to increase his self-esteem, and I used positive discipline only because I maintain self-control. So number four, a positive discipline demands that the adult maintain self-control. The number one problem with self-esteem in children is lack of self-control in adults. Many of us do wonderful things when we're in control of ourselves, and we buy these tapes, and we go to workshops, and we do this and this and this. But the problem is not when we're in control of ourselves. The problem is the stuff we do when we're out of control. I always put this in every talk I do on discipline because it's so vital that we understand that if we maintain self-control, we then can positively discipline children. Now, when we get out of control, two things physiologically happen. One, our adrenal system is cut on. Now, you can imagine now when you're out of control, that means you're very, very angry, which means all anger is fear. You're very, very afraid. You're afraid of losing control of the class. You're afraid of what people might think of you. You're afraid the principal might walk down the hall. You're afraid of what your colleagues might think. You're afraid that your children are going to grow up and be serial murderers. Whatever your fear is, you're very, very frightened. So in that fear, your adrenal system kicks in. Now, your adrenal system sends a message to every cell in your body, fight or flight. Every cell says fight or flight. This sets you up for what's called a coercive trap. Now, a coercive trap is a situation in which you actually teach children the exact behaviors you wish to eliminate. Now, how does this work? As your adrenal system kicks in when you're out of control and you've had all these upsetting thoughts, your adrenal system kicks in, a message goes to every cell in your body, fight or flight. You are then going to arrive on the scene with a child and you are going to fight with them. In other words, you are going to put yourself in a power struggle situation. The child's going to say, no, I'm not. You're going to say, yes, you are. They're going to say, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. They're going to call you names. You're going to call them names. They may try to hit you. You're going to hit them. And it's going to escalate to the point that you are modeling the exact behavior you're trying to get rid of in your child. So as you fight and become out of control, you model aggression. Or maybe you're a flighter person. Let's take an example. And a classic example of this is trying to get out of the grocery store with your child down the checkout lane with all the candy on both sides. A wonderful thing that the sector has done for families is put that candy at the last minute there in a small space. All right, so let's say you structured the situation pretty good. You planned ahead. You have talked to your child, and you have a four-year-old child, and you're going to the store, and you have said, all right, we're going to go into the store. When we go in, we're going to go over to the deli, and you're going to get to pick one thing, any one thing you want. Then we're going to ride around in the store, gather all the things, and when we check out and we get to the candy counter, you may not have candy. You will get your treat at the beginning, not at the end. Do you understand? And as any four-year-old will say, they'll go, sure, oh yeah, sure. Because that's the answer they will give you for everything. So you get to the grocery store, you go in, they select this glazed donut. Drive around, you get all the groceries you need, you pull up to the checkout counter, and the child says, I want candy. And you go, honey, do you remember? We talked. I mean, at this point, the glaze has not even dried on the child's face, and the child's going, I want candy! I want candy! And as they escalate their behavior, and all eyes in public are staring right at you, and in your mind measuring your competence as a parent, your adrenal system kicks in, every cell goes into fight or flight. This time you choose flight. You take about 18 Snickers bars, you throw them in the bag and say, there, may your teeth rot. So what you do is you teach the child in that situation that those techniques that the child used of whining and complaining and throw a tantrum are effective in getting what they want in the world. That is a coercive trap. Whether you fight or flight, you are reinforcing the exact behaviors you're trying to get rid of. So that's going to happen. So you're going to have to be very, very aware that your adrenal systems will kick in. The second thing that happens physiologically when you lose control is that your brain downshifts. Now, right now, if you're thinking about anything I'm saying, or if you're listening to this driving in the car and you're just thinking about where you're going, anything you're thinking about at this moment, it's happening in your conscious brain, and that part of your brain is called your cortex, and it's in your conscious brain. So if you're thinking of anything, it's in your cortex. Now, what happens when you get out of control is your brain downshifts from your cortex, from your conscious brain, into the part of your brain called the unconscious. Now, 115 years ago, Freud said, we have an unconscious. And no one believed him for the longest kind of time. And then we cut up all these rats and monkeys and et cetera, and we said, oh, we found it about 10 years ago. So we do have an unconscious, and it's called the limbic system. So when we get out of control, our brain downshifts from the cortex into our limbic system, and from that position, we cannot think. Now, let me give you an example. First, I want you to think, how many of you out there listening to this tape who've had children of your own or teach with or work with children have said at some point in their life, when I grow up, I'm not going to do that to my children? Something happened in your family of origin, and you grew up and said, oh, when I get older, when I grow up, I'm never doing that to my children. All right. Now, how many of you have already done all those things? Probably everyone out there. What happens is in your limbic system are all the programs you learned from your childhood. So in your limbic system is everything your parents said to you when they were out of control, along with the emotions that go with it. So when a child pushes your button, you allow yourself to have upsetting thoughts. You downshift into your limbic system, open your mouth, and out comes your mother, and you don't even have to move your lips. So what do we do to maintain self-control? One, we get in control of our thoughts. We systematically choose calming thoughts as opposed to upsetting thoughts. We recognize the buttons that we have and what triggers set off upsetting thoughts in ourselves. Once we get an upsetting thought, we immediately recognize it and replace it with a calming thought. The second thing is, we understand that our limbic system will be turned on. We understand that our cortex will downshift. So what you can do is say to yourself in your head, as soon as you feel yourself getting out of control, say to yourself, I'm calm, I am safe, I can help this child or these children with their problems. Now what happens when you do that, if you say, I am calm, sends a message to your adrenal system, cut off. I am safe sends a message to your cortex saying, all right, let's get back up in the cortex, because remember, limbic systems can't think. And I can help this child with his or her problem unhooks you from the child. It recognizes that the problem is the child and keeps it out of ownership from you. Now, it's important that we maintain self-control with children. If you think of the limbic system as a place in which you cannot think from, I want you to understand that as children get out of control and throw temper tantrums, they too are in their limbic system. And you cannot ask questions to a limbic system. You cannot reason with the limbic system. All you can do is soothe a child in their limbic system until they come back to their cortex, where they can make a decision. Let me give you one final example to help you understand the limbic system. If you've ever been in a very fearful situation, now I have been, and one of them was, I thought someone was breaking into my house. So at that moment, I became tremendously fearful. I downshifted out of my cortex into my limbic system, and what did I do? I sat in a chair and watched the front door. Now, as I relayed this story to friends of mine, of course, they all laughed at first, and then they said, well, if it had happened to me, this is what I'd have done. I'd have done this. I'd have called 911. I'd have run out of the house. Well, I thought of those exact things about 10 minutes later or 20 minutes later when I was calm and I moved from my limbic system to my cortex where I could think. So when you're in your limbic system, you cannot think from it, nor can your out-of-control child think from it. All too often, we have an adult in their limbic system and a child in their limbic system, and let me tell you, folks, ain't nobody home. There's not an adult present in that whole situation.